Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions, and we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Well, welcome to our kitchen table today. Glad you, the listener, can join us. I want to talk about spring here. I've got good news and bad news. As far as spring is concerned, it is late in coming here in central Iowa, but there's good parts, but there's also bad parts. Now, a good part is that I come out my door and smells just come up. There are things blooming. The plum trees.
What is that? The plum trees wafting through the woods. Oh, my goodness. Is that heavenly?
Oh, heavenly. The smell. So it's spring. It's spring. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that I found a couple ticks on me already.
Oh, the ticks. The ticks are woke.
They are. So that's your good news, Ben. And there's another good news, bad news. Well, the bad news is no morels yet. No morels, but a little dry.
Well, babe, we're gonna get 5 days of rain. Right. We could get soggy after that.
All right.
You know.
But the good news, I did find a small little clump of ramps. So always something to eat out there. So we have other news from the Donalana Kitchen News Department. That is the Donalana Kitchen News ticker tape there. And here is a news item from Central Iowa. The Iowa Cattlemen's Association awards the award called Iowa's Best Burger. Huh?
To people. Statewide.
Oh, my goodness. It's a big deal.
That's a lot of burgers we got going on here.
The winner this year, it goes to an Ames Restaurant Cafe, Baudelaire, in Campustown, downtown Ames. It is run by Brazilian-born Claudio Gianello and his wife Kelly from Carroll, Iowa. And they got the Best Burger Award for 2018.
Right here in Ames. Oh, boy, oh, boy.
And Claudio says, nothing very fancy. Just settled on a simple combination of salt, pepper, and oregano and put that on a really nice bun.
Okay.
There you go. And using certified Angus beef, okay? Now, I often wondered how this works. Tasting things is very subjective, but the
this is a full-blown rigorous contest. Oh, okay. Right.
People all around the state send in submissions. Nearly 10,000 votes representing around 700 restaurants.
Oh my
goodness!
Sent in.
Oh, so they whittled that down to the top 10, and then Iowa Cattlemen's Association sends out anonymous judges visiting each of the restaurants.
Oh, I want to sign up for that job.
Yeah. And so anyway, three cheers and congratulations to the Café Baudelaire and Claudio Gianello. So, yes, there we go.
Right here in Ames.
And
the best
you've got a meat sort of thing here. What did you find,
Donna?
Yes,
there is a new study from Michigan State University. The headline was, "This Burger Fights Climate Change." Okay, so raised in the right way, grass-fed beef could be part of a carbon-neutral or even carbon-negative diet, according to the new study. So there's this, and we've talked about this a lot, regenerative agriculture and grazing, and we are going to have a lot about that on the show today. But so the latest study, you know, they're trying to, it's quite complicated. You have to figure out what the cow eats, what the cow poops. This is a rigorous scientific study. And of course, cows emit methane. So you have to figure that in. And so what they figured out is the grass-fed system produces, this is the downside. It does, according to them, produce only half as much beef on the same amount of land as the feed lot model. Well, gee, that's kind of obvious when you look at what a feedlot looks like. However, I guess that means if we're going to eat burgers that are not going to add carbon to the atmosphere, we need to eat these grass-fed burgers and only half as many of them as we would normally eat, which is fine. Everybody knows it's healthy to reduce the amount of red meat in your diet for multiple reasons. However, it's good to know that you can still have a good burger and not contribute to climate change, a good guilt-free burger. So
that's good. So this is cows on grass or other
yes.
other things that eat grass. So that bring that is that that sounds like good news. Yes, it does.
I think it is. We have suspected that this was true, that there are, you know, I often say to some of my younger friends who are busy being vegans, because of course we're destroying the planet with too much carbon and da 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 da, and meat and agriculture are a large contributor to that. However, there are things that agriculture can do that mitigate climate. So
that's very good. Oh, so this and this was a study from Michigan State
University.
Well, good for them. See, scientific backing for this stuff.
Yes, I mean, you have to ask. You have to eat beef that was raised in a certain way, and we will be talking a lot more about that today.
Yes. So that brings us to grass, pasture,
and yes, grass fed,
and animals that are amazing. Today, we have a special guest here at the kitchen table, Megan Filbert. She is the Livestock Program Manager for Practical Farmers of Iowa. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks so much, Lana and Donna. Happy to be here.
Good. Megan, tell us what a Livestock Program Manager does.
Sure. I will explain my job at Practical Farmers of Iowa and also my passion for ruminants and livestock and carbon sequestration.
And
I can go into more detail.
Multi-paddock grazing, right?
Absolutely,
okay.
Yes. So very happy to be here as Livestock Program Manager at Practical Farmers of Iowa, or PFI. I work with all of our members that raise livestock and operate livestock farms. So that's across the board. That's
many different ways of doing it.
Many different ways of doing it, you know, from conventional to really small acres of livestock on grass. So I work with mostly beef farmers, some pig farmers, some sheep and goat, and also poultry. So really across the board. And, you know, we're putting on all kinds of events at their farms throughout the year. We hold this annual conference where we feature a whole livestock track of sessions to learn about the latest and greatest in grazing and livestock production. And then, of course, we specialize in doing some on-farm research. So some of the research we've been doing lately is looking at grazing of cover crops and the animal health in those systems, but also the economics of that system. So how much money you could potentially save in your hay costs by being able to graze cover crops in the winter when you
That's
normally...
That's called a win-win, right?
That is a win-win.
Okay.
And not only is it a win for the animals and win for the farmers who are saving money, but it's a win-win-win because of the environmental benefits as
of
well.
Of the cover crops.
Yes.
And the grazing
absolutely.
Animals.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that really brings us to carbon sequestration. And like I said, my passion is for ruminant animals, animals that have a rumen, which is essentially a fermentation vat as their stomach.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a complex stomach with four compartments, and the rumen is part of that. And it ferments cellulose and
they
grass.
They can eat grass when we can't.
Exactly. So ruminants are an incredible type of animals because they can eat land all over the world that can't really be used for anything else. So that's
marginal land can be grazed.
Marginal lands can be grazed. And I believe that we could really get to a system where we're producing more and more grass-fed beef by incorporating more grazing on marginal lands, mm-hmm. which there is more potential that is untapped out there in this state and all over the world.
Right,
to
even
do
in
so.
Iowa where we have good soils, but more particularly in large swaths of semi-arid land all over the globe.
Absolutely.
That is not That's being underutilized.
Yep. And really, those arid lands like Africa, like closer to the equator, that's where we've seen these monumental benefits from incorporating grazing animals. But the key is proper grazing management. So you can't just turn animals out there and let them graze at their will, because they will visit the watering holes over and over again, create compaction issues and create paths and denuded areas that is poor for the soil and poor for erosion and then water quality. They would then poop wherever they wanted, which could be potentially an issue if we're working with a...
Right. The right amount of poop is a good thing because that's
exactly.
fertilizer.
Exactly.
But too much, as in CAFOs, becomes a toxic liability.
Yeah, exactly. So proper grazing management is key. And I'll go into some detail about what that looks like. So really, there are studies like Donna mentioned earlier that talk about grazing animals for a short period of time and moving them on to the next area that has...
There actually is a wonderful Alan Savory YouTube, if anybody wants to look it up, where he talks about that this pattern of short grazing, and his work was really in Africa, that it in nature comes about because the herds who have to stick together, so they clump together because they have a serious predation, or they used to. Anyway, they would naturally move along those pathways because the predators would come around. So in nature, these systems exist. But, of course, we have to replicate that.
Exactly.
Because we don't have the large predators.
So to expand on that point and to paint this picture for you, if you can picture the bison on the prairie.
Yes.
So bison grazed tightly together for safety. You know, mm-hmm. the males and older animals are on the outside of the herd, and the younger animals are towards the middle, being protected from wolves and other predators. And there was no fencing. There was nothing like that. So they had this wide open prairie to graze, and they would take one bite of grass and move on to new grass that hadn't been grazed before, and continually keep moving nomadically. Instead, our systems now, because we only have a certain amount of land, let's say 10 acres, it's all fenced in, and we turn our cows out, what's going to happen if we don't manage the grazing properly is that cows will take a bite of grass and then come back too soon to take a second bite or a third bite of that grass. And that can result in overgrazing, which a lot of the times when we are driving through Iowa and we see pastures and cows out on pastures, a lot of those times those pastures are overgrazed.
Over. They're not clumped together.
They kind of look just like a short clipped golf course, which looks pretty to our eyes. But actually what's happening with the roots of those grasses and in the soil, it's not as beneficial as what we could achieve through proper management.
So if they eat it down too closely, and then does that actually kill the grass?
So what happens?
Or the beneficial
is
grasses?
Yes, it starts to kill the grass.
They only eat dessert, right?
Exactly. They only eat the tenderest shoots, which is the newest shoots that are coming up, and really that then hurts the roots if you eat a blade of grass too soon. So what happens if you eat more than 50% of that plant that is there, or too soon when it's just a new shoot of grass, the roots underneath the soil slough off to an extent where they can't grow back soon enough. So it's all about grazing and letting those animals in a dense herd eat one to two bites of a plant and moving them on to a new untouched pasture. And the second part of this management scheme is letting that pasture that was just grazed rest for the proper amount of time. And really, we want to achieve it. It all depends on the growing season and how fast your forages are growing. But we want to shoot for 20 to 30 to even 60 days to let that pasture rest and totally recover and let those roots recover before it's grazed again. And if you manage your pastures properly from the very start of your grazing season, so right now, you will get more forage production over the entire grazing season and also into subsequent years. So it's all about that grazing right now.
So the science has to do with figuring out what plants they're grazing on, how many cattle, the rainfall, the soil type. It's like a huge mathematical puzzle.
So there are some pretty simple equations out there to figure out. Essentially, it's called stocking density. So it's, you know the average weight of your animals, you know about how many animals you have, and from that information, you can figure out stocking density because you know about how many acres you have. So then you can come up with
– oh, how many animals you should actually have.
Yep. So it's really all about number of animals per acre and time spent on that mm-hmm. on that land. Mm-hmm. And really a lot of that time is through observation and watching how much they're eating and what plants they go for first and
okay,
what plants
so
they go for secondly.
Okay, so this is not machine learning. You actually get out in the pasture and you look at what it
– Observation yeah. okay, is right. a huge part of this.
We still need farmers for
this. There are definitely yeah. equations you can find in books, but observation is key mm-hmm. in with this management. So I guess I would like to explain a little bit about specifically what's happening when cows or sheep or goats are eating grass, what's happening to that plant and to the soil. So the act of grazing, so biting off the tops of a mouthful of grass is saying to that plant, something just bit me. I need to continue to grow and to reproduce. So this is exactly what fire is doing when you're burning ditches, when you're burning pastures. Mm-hmm. You're introducing a disturbance that stimulates that plant to say, I need to grow more and I need to reproduce. So that's the same thing with grazing. So really, in the past, before humans intervened, all grasslands had fires go through them every few years or few
and
months
buffalo.
And had buffalo graze on them. And that's when we really built up this amazing, this organic matter that we're still living off today. So we need to mimic nature. We need to get back to our agriculture systems mimicking nature if we want to see true exponential growth in soil health.
And planetary sustainability.
Yes.
Exactly.
If we want to stick around here.
Exactly. And when I mention increases in soil health, that goes hand in hand with water quality. Because not only when we build more organic matter and increase our soil health, not only can the soil hold more water and there's less runoff, but
– and flooding.
It also helps filter water and it helps mitigate our droughts and our floods. Exactly. So it's all about
– win, 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 win.
All the wins.
Oh, boy.
Yes. A win okay. across the board. So I believe that we truly can use ruminant animals and proper management of grazing to heal our lands.
I have a question. Okay. So we all know – like when I grew up in this Midwestern countryside, all the farmers either had cows or pigs or both or something. There used to be a lot of animals on the land. Mm-hmm. So we're talking 50 years ago mm-hmm. or more. This is no longer true. The fences came down. The corn and soybeans came more and more and more. Are we seeing a reversal in that trend in Iowa?
Yes. Enthusiastically, yes. I see with my job and with mm-hmm. with the Practical Farmers of Iowa members that I work with, I am seeing this reversal of trends. I was actually just at a field day in early April who – a young farmer in his mid-30s who has a feedlot operation but also grazes some of those feedlot animals on cover crops talked about how – his farm looks like a farm from the 1940s. There's 10 acres of this, then there's 10 acres of this, 10 acres of this, and it's just a complete diverse system that animals are rotated throughout the year as well as different crop rotations. So diversity is key in everything in life, but truly in agriculture. So we are seeing lots more different types of crops on the ground, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. with those different types of crops comes larger windows of opportunities to integrate livestock back in the outdoors and back on the land.
Out of the barns and the CAFOs.
Absolutely.
Back in the field.
Absolutely. And I will also say that with this surge of interest from beginning farmers wanting to come back to the land and back to farm, they see livestock as an easier way to get started in farming because it takes less money to invest in cows than it does in a very expensive tractor.
Meat is your most high-value product from
absolutely.
The farm.
Absolutely. Meat and milk.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that this has been going on for many, many thousands of years. Animals, ruminants, can make use of the earth, the grass, and we can make use of them, actually.
Exactly.
There was a writer, agricultural writer, Gene Logsdon, wrote about farm things. And one of his the title of one of his books was All Flesh is Grass. And you think about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, this is a classic. It was in my father's library.
Right, yeah.
So essentially we can grow the healthiest meat for human consumption from sunlight via grass. And that's a pretty incredible thing to think about.
Well, and there is a nutritional difference because grass-fed beef has a completely different fatty acid profile. They have a lot of gamma linoleic acid, which is a good-for-you fat, as opposed to corn-fed fat, which is possibly cholesterol-causing. It's healthier for the animal. It's healthier for the people who eat the animals. It's healthier for the earth. And it tastes pretty good, too.
Exactly. And I'm helping farmers get over that learning curve of raising and finishing grass-fed beef so we can all produce the highest quality product possible.
It is good to have someone with us that is passionate about ruminants. Yes, yes. This is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen. You are listening to the Donalana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. That was an English country dance tune called Buttered Peas, and that's one of those golden oldies. It was first written in 1729. We like to drag up those old, wonderful tunes. Buttered Peas, a good thing for spring. We'd like to talk about good things to eat here on the Donalana Kitchen. I'd like to share a tune with you. It talks about sheep and grains and baking. Believe it or not, here it goes. I don't want none of your weevily wheat. I don't want your barley. Give me some of the best you got to bake a cake for Charlie. Over the river to feed my sheep. Over the river to Charlie. Over the river to feed my sheep on weevily wheat and barley.
Bravo. Very good.
That's an old English folk tune. I think I learned that off an old cassette tape. Remember cassette tapes? Yeah. Let's talk more about grazing and ruminants. And we are here in the kitchen with Megan Filbert from Practical Farmers of Iowa. I would like to talk about sheep and lambs with Megan because
yes,
we have been doing a cooperative venture on Onion Creek Farm. She's been keeping a few sheep on our place, and boy, have I been learning a lot. So tell me about sheep and the wonderful thing that happened this spring.
Oh, I'd love to. So, as you know, I'm pretty much obsessed with livestock, But the holdup being I live in a house in downtown Ames and I do not have a big enough yard to keep the livestock I want to keep. And even if I tried, I wouldn't be grazing them, and my true passion is grazing, so I just can't – I don't have it in my heart to keep animals in a small space. So I approached Joe and Lana at Onion Creek to see if I could keep some sheep at their farm, and now we're in our second year. And what's incredible about this year is that we just got through our first lambing season.
What a joy.
Yeah, so we had 5 baby lambs born starting April 19th and then that following week. So they're about 2 to 3 weeks old now, and they are just growing right along and frolicking in the grass.
Now, this is – you started out with 3 ewes, and this is the first time – They're new ewes. They haven't lambed before. So I was just kind of in a nervous tizzy there for a while. I thought maybe they wouldn't know what they're doing, but they know.
Yes. I was concerned that the coyotes would come and eat.
Yeah, we all had shared those concerns. And so far, fingers crossed, it's been going very, very well. So really the impetus behind bringing sheep to Onion Creek Farm was to add fertility to some vegetable acres that hadn't had animal manure or fertility for at least 20 years. And getting back to believing that livestock and grazing can heal the land, an amazing benefit of these livestock is their manure and the fertility that comes with that manure. And actually using the livestock to spread the manure for us. We don't even have to get out there, load it up in a tractor, and take it out to a field. They're doing it themselves.
Bless their little waggy tail hearts. I think that's a nice thing that they do. And I have, like I said, I have learned a lot. Tell us about the kind of sheep that you – the kind of breeding and how birthing a lamb works.
Absolutely. My favorite topic. So these are Katahdin sheep. They're named after the mountain in Maine because I believe the person that originally brought Katahdins to the United States brought them to near Katahdin, Maine. So this breed of sheep is gaining a lot of popularity because they're hair sheep. And a lot of people, you know, when you say you have sheep, they automatically say, oh, do you have them for the wool? And these are not wool sheep. They actually they molt. They shed their outer coat, their winter coat, and they're in the process right now. And it's pretty incredible to just watch their outer coat fall off.
It looks big and fuzzy, but it isn't the kind of wool that you would spin.
Exactly.
So you don't do anything with it?
No. I've actually tried felting with it just for fun. And the fibers just aren't – they're just not made for it.
But they don't have to be sheared.
Do not have to be sheared. Okay. So that is the key because shearing a sheep is backbreaking work. There are fewer and fewer shearers out there. And
– especially in our neighborhood.
Because there are few shearers, they don't want to invest in the time to just go shear 3 sheep, right? That they can't do that economically. It doesn't work out. So these hair sheep, they produce amazingly tasty meat and they don't have to be shorn. And so that is another win-win for a lot of farmers. So it takes the shearing chore off the list and you still get a really tasty product from these animals. So I've loved that these Katahdins are extremely hardy animals. I've had no issues with parasites, so parasites are a number one issue when raising goats and sheep. And they're known to be a breed that is more resistant genetically to internal parasites, which is excellent. So I've had no parasite issues, and like Lana said, we were all a little bit nervous about their first time lambing since these ewes are only a year and a few months old when they had their first lambs. I got a call from Onion Creek one day while I was at work and, oh, there are 2 lambs on the ground and they were up already
With
no help at all. They were born early in the morning and they kind of popped right out, and within 20 minutes, these animals are up on their legs and looking for the udder and starting to milk. So, and that really goes back to, you know, sheep are preyed on. And in the wild, these animals need to be up within minutes of birth or else they're going to be snagged, right? And you think about the analogy of a baby bear and how bears are with their mothers and they don't have to fend for themselves at all for mm-hmm. at least a year. Just like human babies, we're pretty helpless for a long time.
Well, right, because the mamas in both cases have teeth. I think we, exactly. You know, the mammals would, or those mammals would defend.
Exactly.
And I don't know that mothers, these mother sheep, you know, kind of make a stand, but still they are prey to some things.
Yes, they are. So ruminant animals, because they're herbivores, they have to be ready to go as soon as they're born. And so I've been impressed with how these lambs have just grown and have been able to fend for themselves right off the bat. But also the mothering behavior and that protective behavior has really come through with these ewes. Mm-hmm. And it's been fantastic to see them be excellent mothers. Their udders are full of milk. I haven't had any issues with mastitis and infection of the udder. I will say that, you know, I only have 3 ewes and 5 lambs. As I scale up in the future, I fully expect some lambing issues. That's something to be expected. When you have livestock, you will potentially have dead stock. I've always heard that.
Well, yeah, you have to be prepared with that sort of thing. I have not had sheep before, but even a flock of chickens or a flock of ducks, you know, life is pretty tenuous. You lose a few every now and then. Are these the different kind of breeds, are there different mothering, different birthing possibilities for each breed?
Absolutely. So some breeds are known for prolificacy, meaning how many babies they have.
Ooh.
So I know Finn sheep have, I mean, 4 sheep, 4 lambs is not that unheard of with Finn sheep. So I would say Katahdins aren't known for prolificacy. They have 1 to 2, maybe 3 lambs. But since sheep have 2 teats, I think that 2 lambs is really our best ratio there. So both lambs are getting hopefully an equal amount of milk. A lot of times when you have triplets, it's a situation where one lamb may become orphaned and the mother doesn't have enough milk for it. So you end up bottle feeding it, which is fun for a while until it becomes way too much of a chore.
Yes. That's right. Well, after going through this birth process and 2 of the ewes that were on Onion Creek Farm did have twins. And when I see the size of these things, I can't imagine carrying twin lambs. How long is the gestation?
The gestation is 5 months.
Uh-huh.
So when you're planning ahead for when you want your lambs to be born.
Planning.
You count back 5 months to when you need to introduce a ram to your ewes. So I knew that I wanted to have lambs in the spring with the coming of grass. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to be born on grass and to have plenty of grass to eat to produce enough milk. Certainly there are farmers that have lambs earlier, closer to the winter, so they can produce lambs for the Easter market. Since lamb is a traditional food for mm-hmm, Easter, mm-hmm. You can get high market prices for lamb that's ready around Easter, but you want your lambs to be about 5 months old.
Ah.
So you need to plan, you know, Easter was on April 1st this year, so therefore you really needed to have lambs in the middle of winter.
Which means that maybe are those kinds like born in barns and a little warmer?
Exactly.
Okay.
You really need a barn to be able to produce lambs for Easter. I would feel more comfortable with the barn. But at Onion Creek, we're also doing this with – it's very DIY and low infrastructure.
You bet.
So we're making it work with minimal inputs, which is – I'm – which is exactly how I want to do it. And
these,
so,
these sheep were not in a barn. All went,
well,
yes.
Well, but you have a sort of little manger-like structure.
We do. We have this perfect little manger.
Yeah, it's very cute.
It actually was a child's loft, a bed. And so we basically closed in the bottom portion of the loft, three sides of it. So they have this like three-sided shelter. And so in the winter, it was fantastic to keep them out of the wind. And we put it in a sunny area so they could always like get some sun but still be protected from the elements. And now we're planning, since it's been getting hot already, we're planning to move it to a shady area so it'll then it'll act as their shade structure. And we're going to take the sides off so then we can get some cross ventilation throughout the
– a portable manger.
Yes, exactly. It's a portable manger. It's fantastic. And they love it.
They really – well, with any animal, you end up – they have personalities. Of course, they have names. But – do other sheep do this? These are the most vocal animals, especially the one that we call Gloria. She is just really, she baas all the time.
So, yes, other animals do this because I know this. I actually Googled spoiled sheep never stops baaing. And there was a whole thread on people talking about their spoiled sheep. So it's not just us, Lana.
Oh, thank you.
but it comes from, you know, sneaking some cups of grain to those animals. Corn and oats just truly taste like candy to them. Yeah. And once they've had a taste for it, they know it's out there. They're always going to want it. So I will say that we had a lot of vocalization during the winter when the grass wasn't green. But now that they're out grazing, as of yesterday, I did not hear – I heard some baas, but they weren't that same noise. It was like more gentle, soft baas in agreement with what was going on. And they're not craving that candy anymore because they have the green grass.
We've broken the habit. However, you did mention, and this is a brand new idea to me, that mother sheep have a special little communication with their own little lambs so the little lambs know which udder to go to.
Absolutely. So I learned this at graduate school at Cornell.
Oh, what a good thing to learn. Go ahead.
Yes. One of my office mates was studying maternal behavior in sheep. And she was recording sheep and watching the behaviors with their lambs. And she learned that Each lamb and each mother have a specific small, it's not even a baa, I don't know what I can call it, it's just this small little noise that they, to the human ear, it doesn't sound any different. We can't, every sheep and lamb sound the same to us. But they have a very specific that only mother and lamb have, and that's how they can identify each other in a big herd. And you hear that when they get separated from each other, it gets a little stronger. But those noises, we're hearing a whole new set of noises now that those ewes have lambs, and they're nice.
And lambs only – well, I suppose the ewes see to this. The ewes won't generally take on a lamb that's not theirs.
Absolutely not. So I saw in that first week of life, I saw the lambs, you know, they're kind of confused. They don't really know what's going on, and they're just going to the udder that's closest to them. And they would go up to an udder that's not of their mother, and that mom would headbutt it away because that milk is for my baby, not you. And that's a sign of great mothering ability.
Mm-hmm. So. Oh, that's very good. So we have learned a lot, and it's a lovely thing to experience, and I do hope it keeps on going. Oh, I have a question. You mentioned stocking density. We've got about, 2 acres, including the working vegetable parts of our land, and we've got a little bit of prairie. How many, right now, there are 8 sheep out there, eight sheep, big ones and little ones, and 2 acres of bits and pieces. How many sheep would our place take?
I would have to do some calculations specifically on what the land could actually the capacity, the carrying capacity, it's called. But I think that if we grazed properly so we could produce as much forage as possible, we could stock up to 20 sheep.
Oh, you're kidding.
On these acres. Oh, yeah, I really think.
I think maybe we should hire like a kid for the summer and give him a shepherd's crook.
Exactly.
And, wouldn't that be nice?
I know.
You can kind of push
a nomadic herder.
Oh, well, see, the idea of grass, turning grass into meat and grass into animals. And it is the sheep and lamb experience on Onion Creek Farm has really been a dandy. Yes, we've been talking to Megan Filbert. This is KHOI 89.1. Welcome back. You are listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We are talking sheep. Well, we talked about cows before that, but there is something that happens, and we were talking about this before the show started. Donna, you wanted to ask about frisking and cavorting.
Yeah. Well, first I ask, is there a word for that when the animal, like, kind of leaps for joy?
Right, and I call it frolicking, and I don't know if there's an actual word for it. I want to know.
Yeah.
If there's a word for
it. Well, do like buffaloes do it too?
Oh, I would imagine that baby buffaloes do it.
Yeah.
Well, you have to Google that now. That's good. But the idea of, well, absolute joy. I mean, all right, so they're responding to food, but I would consider that absolute joy. And also, I've been noticing these little lambs, when they kind of get up underneath their mom and find breakfast there, their little tails just go corkscrew, corkscrew. Yeah, you'd think that they probably can't drink without their tails going around. I don't know.
I don't think so. Every single time that tail is just flopping in the air. And I think that is a sign of happiness.
Well, there's a research paper there.
Yeah.
I just know it is.
Well, this is a very spring thing. Like, I've seen it all over the internet. When the cows get first let out of the barn, this is not just for little baby lambs. They like gallop and jump around and
we all
get excited about it.
I've heard of this festival in Denmark. It's something like the strolling of the cows, and it's that first time after the long winter that the dairy cows are let out of the barn, and it's this festival where thousands and thousands of spectators come and line up on the fences around the pasture and watch the cows leave the barn, and the cows are just kicking up dirt and just, you know, jumping on each other and making noises, and it's just incredible to watch these cows twirl around.
Joyful, joyful.
Pure joy.
So all the people come from the cities and go visit the farms to see the cows.
I would love to
be happy.
We should do that in Iowa.
That's good.
We should have a day when all of the animals get let out of the...
I just watched a video of Lost Lake Farm and Jewel doing that. And those cows just ran out there and they were full of life and joy.
What a wonderful thing to celebrate.
It's funny how it elicits the same thing in humans. You look at that and... You can't help but, I mean, you must be enjoying seeing the baby sheep jump around all over the place.
It's a joy. And even though this is just a small little group that I've gotten to know, I mean, they have big herds, of course. We have a very small little flock. And when the older ewes kind of move off and the lambs are left behind, they all kind of realize, oh, shoot. And then they frolic. They move like a family already. They although, like you said, the mothers are very protective of their very own, they stick together quite
absolutely
well.
And sheep are herd animals. They function best around each other. They're not no animal is an individual. Well, I guess there probably are a few examples, but sheep especially have this herd mentality where they're just at rest and at ease around each other.
Mm-hmm. Oh, mention a little bit about how the fencing. How do you tell them where to go?
Yeah, so I have this fantastic mobile fencing. So this is part of our low input. We have no permanent fencing. So I have this electro netting, it's called, and I bought it from Premier One Supplies, which is actually local. It's in Washington, Iowa, and I used this stuff where all over when I've worked with livestock on the East Coast as well. So all farmers know about this fencing, but it's this portable fencing, and it's basically a white netting, and it has small wires, electric wires running through it, so it carries electricity from its charge source. So it just, when sheep touch it or when predators touch it on the other side, it gives them a small electric shock. And I've been shocked by it a few times.
It works.
It's not so bad.
It works.
Makes you feel alive. And it just, it then becomes, once they learn it physically through that electrical shock, it becomes a psychological barrier. And then I can move this fence wherever I want them to graze. So it's been instrumental in grazing some invasive species, like on the brushy banks where we want to control some multiflora rose or honeysuckle. We've been able to fence them in and graze it. I asked Lana's neighbor yesterday if he wants his yard grazed. Because I have mobile fencing, I can do that. So it just opens up a lot of opportunities when you have this mobile infrastructure.
Isn't technology great?
It's
a very low-tech but useful sort of thing.
Now, the mobile fencing, does it come in different heights for different animals?
Absolutely does. Yeah. So I've seen there's pig fencing, there's poultry fencing, there's sheep fencing, there's cow fencing. So different heights, different strands, different sizes of the openings, the holes within the netting. Mm-hmm. And so modern fence technology is fantastic. The latest thing that's been on my mind is virtual fencing.
Oh, come now.
So there's actually – they use this a lot in Australia because there's no predators in Australia. But I saw a company in California recently. They have this like prototype fence called Vents that's virtual fencing. And basically it's an ear tag in the animal's ear that sends either a beep or a buzz. And it buzzes them. And it's not – I don't even think it's a buried underground fence like you would an invisible dog fence. Mm-hmm. It's GPS technology.
Oh.
So you could be sitting on your iPhone and determine the border you want these animals where to graze and keep them moving. And I think this has incredible potential for grazing these marginal lands because a huge barrier is the cost of fencing. And the actual building of the fencing.
And someone to move it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, predators would be an issue in that system. But for cows, if you think about it, we only use one strand now to keep cows in. So it's not like we're protecting from predators in mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. case. So I think for cows, this could be a fantastic modern adaptation. We should take advantage of this technology.
What a neat idea.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of neat stuff coming down the road. And it's so nice to hear about grazing and all the stuff that's happening in the
spring. It's like giving each cow their cell phone.
Oh goodness. Oh, they'll be playing games. You just watch it. PFI, Practical Farmers of Iowa, has field days. People contact you and they go out and learn things. Are there some interesting things?
You can visit farms.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Tell us what's coming up.
Yes. So I want to mention three different field days. So there's a field day on June 28th at Bill and Stacy Borenpohl's. That's just south of Dubuque, so other side of the state. But that's all about diversified livestock, grazing, and the infrastructure they put in for conservation. Then we have Scott Wiedemeyer. He's a dairy farmer, a grazer. He sells milk to Organic Valley. That's on July 14th, and that's in Maynard, Iowa, also in northeast Iowa. But those are some grazing-based field days that are going to be available in our field day guide and online at practicalfarmers.org. Then there's also this hands-on animal health field day where we're going to learn from veterinarians on how to identify sick animals, what to record when you think you have a sick animal, what to talk to your vet about, what to take pictures of, how to castrate, how to vaccinate, all of those hands-on skills that we might be rusty in. And that's in September 14th. One other event I want to mention is we are taking a bus or van full of interested people to a conference called the GrassFed Exchange. So this is like the premier grazing event in North America every year. It moves around. This year it's in Rapid City, South Dakota. So it's 8 hours away. And to make it possible to go, PFI has arranged for transportation. So I am taking a group full of farmers to the Grass-Fed Exchange June 20th through the 22nd in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Sounds like a party.
It will be a grazing party, my kind of party.
Oh, very good. Very good. Lots of good stuff happening from Practical Farmers website. Give that so you can.
Practicalfarmers.org.
Got it. Great. Donna, there is something, there's more upcoming stuff. There's a tea party coming
up.
Oh, yes. What's going on this weekend?
We're having a tea party, literally a tea party. I called it a tea party because I think we need to reclaim the culinary value of a tea party. It's not a political party. It's just for all political persuasions. Kirsten Anderson is coming to speak about sexual harassment in Ames. Now, Kirsten Anderson was something for the Republican Party. I've forgotten what she was, but she worked for the Republican Party, and she had sexual harassment in her workplace, and she filed a complaint, and she was fired for filing that complaint. So she went to court, and she was awarded a rather large amount of money because this is a serious issue, and they done her wrong. So she's going to come in and explain about what sexual harassment in the workplace is like. It's sort of like I'm calling it the kind of our own Iowa Me Too movement moment. And so this is Saturday at 2 o'clock at the – what's the church? Lana, what's the church?
St. John's by the campus.
Right. It's right on
across from the memorial. Well, not quite. Across from Lake Laverne, across from – on Lincoln Way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And, yeah, that's May 12th, Saturday, May 12th.
2 o'clock. And we are literally having a tea party. Lana and I are baking cookies and scones and fudge, and Little Woods Herb is bringing really delicious tea. And it is a time to come and socialize and learn.
This is an important thing. And
it's a fundraiser for the radio station.
This event is a fundraiser for this fine community radio station. So get to meet Donna and I. We'll feed you.
Yeah, right. If you ever wondered what our food really tastes like, this is an opportunity.
And Donna will do herself up proud. She always does. So it's really fun. It's good. And come and we'll discuss an important issue. Support the radio station that helps bring this to your ears. Yes, community radio.
Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock in Campus Town at the St. John's by the campus. Am I saying it right? Church? I can't find it in here. Anyway, so come on. Oh, yes, here it is. St. John's by the Campus Episcopal Church, 2338 Lincoln Way. And do be careful about parking in Campus Town. It has some limitations. So
yes, there's a little bit of parking south of the church, but you can park on the street on Lincoln Way, and the ISU ramp is not far away. So do come this Saturday, 2 o'clock. Also, there are some other upcomings.
Well, yes, for one, Sharon Stewart at the Lockwood Cafe, who makes crepes and serves wonderful coffee, is now open. That is out on Reliable Street on the – How do you get there, Lana? It's on the way to your house.
Northwest edge of Ames. Reliable Street. Find North Dakota Avenue and go north. You'll find it.
It's the big old elevator out there. So Sharon makes really delicious crepes, and now she is open again for the season. It's out of doors. Tuesday through Saturday, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. You can check her Facebook page.
Very good. That's the Lockwood Cafe. And also, Friday, May 11th, this happens. This is becoming a regular sort of thing here in Ames. It is the annual Foodies and Brew event here in Ames. Food and brew. Good combination. All sorts of participating
dishes. Lots of
dishes.
Local food and local brews. And
from 6 to 9 at May 11th, that's Friday, and they're doing a good one here, at the Ames Municipal Airport Hangar to celebrate the new hangar, but also to keep things dry and tidy. So,
right. For the last few years, it's been they shut off the street in front of the radio.
Which was good.
But we've had some weather issues,
there's
so
been some
this
issues.
Year they're doing it indoors. Bravo.
There's been some issues, but Foodies and Brew, there you go. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can hear us every Tuesday at noon, repeated 7 p.m. We've had music by Hesperus playing from their CD, Early American Roots. Thanks to our special guest, Megan Filbert. We'll go out with some thoughts on grazing by that wise folk singer Burl Ives. Maresy dotes and dozy dotes and little lambs eat ivy. A kid will eat ivy too. Wouldn't you? I would.
Old favorite song.
Yeah. My name is Lana Noctival.
And I'm Donna Priskintos.
We've had fine engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.